This is Michael McCusker. A couple of things I'd like to read this morning, one of which I hadn't planned until I read it in the New York Times, and it's rather interesting to most of the demographics, you might say, of KMUN and the satellite stations. It's called "I May Be 50, But Don't Call Me a Boomer." And it's by Richard Perez Pena, and it appeared in this last Sunday, New York Times, January 12th. There is no baby boom generation. Oh, sure, there was a baby boom, a neatly defined pig-in-the-python bulge from 1946 to 1964. But the kind of broadly shared cultural experiences that could bind together people across that whole span, that just did not happen. This year, the youngest of the baby boomers, the youngest, mind you, turned 50. I hit that milestone a few months back. But we aren't what people usually have in mind when they talk about boomers. They mean the early boomers, the post-war cohort, most of them now in their 60s, not us later boomers, labeled Generation Jones by the writer Jonathan Pontell. The boom generation really has two distinct halves, which in my mind I call Boomer Classic and Boomer Reboot. Wonder where you stand? There is a quiz on the online version of this article, so I guess you'll have to find that. The differences between them have to do, not surprisingly, with sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and economics and war. For a wide-ranging set of attitudes and cultural references, it matters whether you were a child in the 1940s and 50s or in the 1960s and 70s. And it probably matters even more whether you reached adulthood before or after the early 70s, a time of head-spinning changes with long-term consequences for families, careers, and even survival. The end of the war in Vietnam makes for one especially sharp dividing line. In 1973, the ceasefire was signed. United States forces were withdrawn, and the last American draftees were inducted, although the war actually ended in 1975, 2 years later. If you were an early boomer, even if you were not drafted or shipped to Vietnam, you had friends, classmates, or relatives who were. The fathers you knew had served in World War II and probably thought their sons should answer the call also. The war was a raw, central presence in young people's lives and in the nation's cultural and political battles. Late boomers like me had none of that. No war, no draft, no defining political cause, and most of our fathers were too young for World War II. I remember, as a teenager, seeing old footage of the riots outside the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago and thinking, people my age don't feel that strongly about anything. People raised in the immediate post-war years had more faith in their government and an idealistic view of America that curdled in the 60s and 70s. My childhood memories of the evening news, on the other hand, include the war, protests, Watergate, and the dour faces of Johnson and Nixon, not the grins of Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy. In this way, I think we late boomers have more in common with the jaded Generation X that followed. We had less idealism to spoil. No, I don't remember where I was when Kennedy was killed and innocence died. I was an infant. But I sure remember where I was when Nixon resigned and cynicism reigned. Older boomers may have wanted to change the world. Most of my peers just wanted to change the channel. Another line between the eras runs through the bedroom. It's not that premarital sex, casual sex, and even anonymous sex were unknown in earlier times. But when early boomers were teenagers in the back seats of their cars, it was understood that sex was dangerous. Then came the birth control pill, first marketed in 1961, but because of various state laws, not universally accessible until 1972, and legal abortion, Roe v. Wade was in 1973. They helped create a window of time, 10 to 15 years, when, for the first time, people could convince themselves, and many did, that there could be sex without consequences. AIDS slammed that window shut in the 1980s. But it was in that opening that late boomers reached adolescence and early adulthood, developed their sexual attitudes, and embarked on their sex lives. People my age took for granted the sexual freedom that had been revolutionary to older boomers. But if sex got easy, then marriage, it seemed, got hard. More babies were born to single mothers, and between the late 1950s and the late 70s, the divorce rate tripled. Compared with early boomers, my cohort was a lot more likely to grow up with only one parent around. If you were born in the late 40s, you probably didn't know anybody who had tried illegal drugs while you were in high school, maybe not even into your 20s. If you tried anything yourself, it probably felt like a big deal, a transgression, or even a statement. If you were a little younger, from the middle of the boom, you were more likely to know drug users, but it was still a dividing line, a kind of us and them marker. Then the floodgates opened, once again, in the 1970s. When the Gallup organization asked about marijuana use in 1969, 8% of adults under 30 admitted to having tried it. A mere 8 years later, it was 56%. We late boomers, going to high school in the 70s, knew plenty of people who had tried drugs when we were in high school, including teachers and parents, and we knew many more in college. To a lot of us, marijuana never seemed like a very big deal. Macroeconomics form another dividing line, also in the early 70s. By then, nearly all of the first half boomers had finished school and started their working lives. They had lived through a period of historic economic growth when it seemed a rising tide really did lift all boats. People just a few years younger grew up with that kind of prosperity, but it evaporated when they reached the age to seize it. From 1973 to 1982, the United States suffered through three recessions, two energy crises, inflation, and high unemployment, a disillusioning time to establish a career. Things were different still for those of us at the tail end of the boom. We grew up with the pessimism of that era, but we entered the workforce during the 80s boom when the tide lifted many boats, but not others. The boomer generation also straddles a revolution in the roles of women, with the first half more likely to fight past old assumptions and the second more likely to reap the gains. When early boomers were children and young adults, American women were far less likely than men to go to college or hold jobs. The gaps narrowed slowly for decades, but here again, an inflection point came in the early 70s when women's numbers began to soar. In 1970, women were 41% of college students. By 1979, they were a majority. In 1972, 51% of American women, ages 25 to 54, were in the workforce. By 1989, the figure was 74%. In pop culture, there's just no parallel in the amount of political content, darkness, and skepticism we grew up with. First half boomers got all of those things, but later in life, and they were new and challenging for us. They were part of the landscape. The early boomers were born into a world without rock and roll, swearing in the media, or even much in the way of really harsh satire. A lot of us late boomers can't remember a time before the British invasion, Hunter S. Thompson, and George Carlin. The gap between the two halves of the baby boom may best be summed up by some of the staples of radio and TV when we were kids. The classic boomers had Mr. Sandman and Leave It to Beaver. We rebooted boomers, sympathy for the devil and all in the family. And that was by Richard Perez Pena. I may be 50, but don't call me a boomer. Myself, I precede the boomers. I was born in 1941, and I always felt them breathing down my neck. As Satchel Paige famously said, don't look back, something might be gaining. Well, I'd like to read something now that I wrote. So I have to use my disclaimer, I guess, that this is my opinion, and my opinion only, perhaps, in all of the parallel universes and cosmoses and all the dark matter in between. One world for all. And I begin it with a quote by the historian A.J.P. Taylor. History is just one damned thing after another. Humanity's sly calculation of time might not fit any other world than its own, and even so is a compromise between observation and superstition. This beginning of an adolescent year of the third millennium of the Christian calendar might be an opportunity to reassess a few perceptions of human reign over our very small, crowded planet. One of the larger misperceptions of our era is that early civilizations and the people who lived in them are archaic and beyond any relevance. We consider them as old, decayed, even decadent periods, vanished into the fog of history and myth. But those were not the old times. They were actually the young times. This is the old time. Earth is getting older. Our species is aging. Our civilization approaches Alzheimer's. Our ancient ancestors were not the wintry grayheads we regard them as. They are instead the vigorous youth of Homo sapiens, ecstatic, reckless children, wildly avaricious and ruthlessly violent. We ought to think of them, without condescension, as the youthful nursery of our species. We too often scorn our ancestors as naive and aboriginal, and we condescendingly regard their epochs as simpler periods compared to our own generation's modernity, actually post-modernity, and sophistication. We forget what they learned for us, nearly everything we know. We are what they bequeathed us, an inseparable umbilical of maturation as well as deterioration. We are the old ones, born much later in Earth's age than our predecessors, whose brilliant, inspired youth constructed our own golden middle age. For all our technological skill, we are innervating beings absorbed in our comfort zones, a species lethargic dream of an effortless materialistic paradise, a sign of incipient senility. Young millenarians believe they pioneer a new future of galactic cyberspace, but they are later evolutions of Earth, older than everyone else the instant they are born. And they inherit a stricken planet our species has mistreated like a savage child. We are at the cusp of a new millennium, already moving rapidly into its realm of time with the acceleration of a starship. A millennium is an awesome thought when you think about it, and we look into this new one in fearful anticipation, numb from too much change too quickly. We are skeptical of the future, not only because our corpses lie somewhere up the near timeline, but our concerns for the future are seriously handicapped by a possibility of endless wars against phantoms who have very different dreams and are able to strike anywhere at any time to express them. But we are also worried by a grim perception that we have grievously injured our home planet and that most of the familiar guideposts are continually ripped away, leaving us perplexed about what is next. A millennium evokes old prophecies, apocalyptic cults that believe the end is close at hand and flourish to make it likely. The world was scheduled to end at the first millennium of the Christian age with an identical script, as well as scripture, of Armageddon, with the exception we have developed the means to accomplish the abominations ancient prophecy continues to incite. Our collective angst is world suicide, brought on by the conflict of our parallel tendencies of piety and murder. Our past grips the present grimly. We feel out of phase. We sense we have lost control, or are out of control, as we lunge into this new century millennium with accelerating velocity. We instinctively resist change, even as we promulgate it. Change percolates chaos. Our fear is that we are being forcibly propelled into an unknown future in which we will only recognize ourselves opaquely, moving through an indistinct environment. A future worldwide civilization of colossal promise and terror is projected. Gene splitting, recombinant DNA, invented and patented life forms. These human tamperings with the secrets of life frighten the majority of us more than the continuing possibility of obliteration. We live at present in an age of intellectual reversion, of appalling descent into public ignorance and intolerance, which are generally present but not given the forum or esteem of recent years. We pay serious, nearly morbid attention to the pathological pieties and simplifications of idealytical zealots who act at the extreme edge of our anxieties and reduce the national dialogue to a medieval level reminiscent of witch burnings. Although we are inclined to measure progress through technical achievement, it should be as important to concentrate on the contradictory evolution of political liberty and the slow development of a world civilization. Marx anticipated such a civilization in the 19th century, and the two world wars of the 20th century made it impossible to resist. Nuclear power, the fortress of nationalism, has rendered it obsolete. The contradiction lies with the rights and liberties of individuals and minorities, and with former colonies and subject nations that have been released from foreign dominance and reassert their claims as separate and independent peoples, while genociding themselves with ancient feuds and virulent ethnic cleansing. Another contradiction is that a few very powerful persons and multinational corporate conglomerates wish to rule the world in much the manner previous dictators, fascists, and communists dreamed of doing. International class war is replacing nationalism, and its first real aspect is the spiteful war on terrorism conducted by the Christian West against the Islamic East. The voguish New World Order is a direct schism between the rich and the poor. The two-party system in the United States reflects this class war. Two political parties don't represent the people of the country any more than Congress, the White House, or Wall Street. Prospects of forming third and fourth parties are predicated on the assumption that a two-party system actually exists. Instead, it is one party with two bantering heads. The true second party is made up of the disenfranchised, who seldom take part in the political process, essentially because, in a famous complaint, they do not believe in a constitution that doesn't believe in them. The only real political parties in the USA are the rich party and the poor party. The raw excesses of corporate capitalism in its quest to dominate world trade and commerce since the end of the Cold War, represented by the empirical rise of the USA, are under siege, however, by a mounting turbulence caused by intense pressure from the politically and monetarily abused bottom of the resource trickle-down, which threatens to unite with the rest of the world's majority of overcrowded humanity struggling for a decent living on the planet. This upheaval has the possibility of collating every previous civil rights and working class struggle, and might very well readjust the center of power and pioneer the first truly universally human community in its long evolution. The major barrier to that universal community is, ironically, the United States, which consistently declares itself the only form of governance capable of uniting the world's peoples into an umbrella democracy of its own form. Paradoxically, at the very moment that democracy languishes in the homeland at the hands of a plutocratic regency. The United States has evolved to world supremacy in two centuries since its revolution, which has been the ambition all along, despite fearful and protective tendencies toward isolation. A history of the USA is not nearly as much an evolution of democracy as it is more essentially its rise as a world superpower. The two world wars of the 20th century made the United States a superpower, during which it built a war machine unsurpassed in history, while demonstrating a productive capacity that overwhelmed allies and enemies alike. This nation was created by war, maintained its union by war, became a continental power by decimating native peoples and invading its southern neighbor and stripping it of its northern half, and became a world power by terminating the decrepit colonial empire of another. The United States is among history's most successful militant societies and now dominates global politics with its immense and highly sophisticated potential for total war as the only reigning superpower after emerging the victor of the half-century Cold War, a term credited to George Orwell, against communist Russia, which was characterized by inconclusive brushfire wars and a horrendous nuclear arms race that economically and politically broke its competitor, but seriously injured its own economies and ideologies. The collapse of the Soviet Union and subsequent disappearance of communism from major regions of the world has significantly reduced the options and bargaining power of so-called third world nations. The end of the Cold War and Soviet communism gave the industrial northwestern part of the world tremendous power to reshape the politics and economies of the southern and eastern areas. A major consequence has been that the USA, the world's remaining superpower, has been able to act aggressively with impunity in these parts of the world without the threat of Soviet counteraction as prevailed for nearly half a century. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq after 9/11 have been an attempt to put the world on notice. Although America's position on the international market is weak with domestic recession and gross mismanagement of its economy that has resulted in mass insolvency within the nation, especially the near collapse of its middle class, the USA's military potency is unmatched, and it is willing and capable of sending troops and armed robotic drones anywhere on Earth at any real or perceived provocation, or for no discernible reason except an arrogant desire to do so. The current realities of world commerce have adversely affected American labor. Real work has been transferred overseas as corporate exploitation moves like a cancer through American culture. The country is more or less governed by a council of merchants similar to medieval Venice, with the exception of a comic charade of outer layer political marionettes who act out Punch and Judy theatrics. Cheaper labor and manufacturing costs in third world nations not only add to the imbalance of trade but considerably shrink the jobs of American workers as the U.S. economy has shifted from a producer nation to a boom and bust financial casino in which computer programmers, accounts clerks, and stockbrokers are more important to the economy than steel workers or farmers. The foundations of the modern interdependent world economy were laid in the late 19th century, with business cartels dominating international trade in raw materials through colonizing most of the third world and infusing billions of dollars into foreign capital investment, primarily in Eastern Europe by Western Europe, North America, and European colonies. The two major industrial powers in 1900 were Germany and the United States. The USA started the 20th century by inheriting, as a result of a brief triumphant war, the remaining vestiges of moribund Spain's deteriorated empire and became overnight a world empire, except that its new empire was situated on islands rather than mainlands. The real power the United States developed over the last century was through a surrogate form of colonialism, dominance by proxy control of foreign economies, industries, politicians, and generals, with coercion matched by corruption instead of occupation and colonial ministries. The Great Depression of the 1930s was an outcome of the collapse of the inflated American stock market and caused worldwide financial ruin, dried up international trade, and created mass unemployment, 12 million in the U.S. alone by 1932. Franklin Roosevelt won the presidential election that year with his promise of a New Deal to end the Depression and set in motion reforms and economic stimulation, including protection of labor unions for the first time, plus wage and hour laws, all of which have been under intense assault ever since. Social Security was initiated by FDR, presently in danger of being thoroughly looted, and public works programs were revitalized on a massive scale. Huge dams, rural electrification projects, CCC programs, aid to small farmers, hardly any of which has been instituted in the latest comparable financial disaster. But ultimately, accelerated military spending and the advent of World War II literally changed the nation's fortunes. The burden of destroying Nazi Germany fell primarily upon capitalist America and communist Russia. Essentially, the U.S. provided the material and Russia the human power. After the war, these nouveau superpowers polarized the world into two nuclear-armed camps separated by an infamous Iron Curtain, Winston Churchill's term, which symbolized their fierce competition for worldly supremacy. 1 year short of its platinum anniversary, Bolshevik communism disintegrated into ruin and chaos. Once hoped to be the essential revolution of the masses against the long history of political and economic repression, Bolshevism quickly developed into a monstrously cruel and eventually stagnant system that simply fell apart from the mendacious inertia of its own history. The vast empire of Russian republics and East European satellites collapsed into bitter splinters of ancient hatreds as around the world communism was simultaneously rejected as a successor to colonialism and as the structure and ideology of newly enfranchised governments. Instead of seizing the future and proclaiming a, quote, new man through world revolution, communism swiftly diminished as a relic of the past into the dustbin of history, the god that both failed and died, which has left the United States as the world's only superpower at the beginning of the 21st century. The deceit that capitalism and democracy are intertwined quickly came apart following communism's collapse. The result is that the USA has failed to show itself to the world as a true democracy, corrupting its real manifest destiny with the decrepit quest for plutocracy and empire, much to the disgust and discouragement of the rest of the world. And that is something I wrote. And as I say, it's my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in all of the myriad cosmos.